Hi everyone, I'm Stephen Downs. Welcome back again to Ethics Analytics and the Duty of Care. We're still in Module 6. I kind of apologize for that because this is going on for quite a while, but there is a lot to talk about here, and a lot of this stuff is new needs to be brought out and explained in some detail. So anyhow, Module 6 is the Duty of Care. And this particular video is on caring democracies. And this was the main focus of some writers. And I'm thinking especially Joan Tronto and Nell Noddings. It's a topic that occupies the thought of a lot of people who are writing about the ethics of care, and especially writing about the ethics of care in an educational context, because there's such a close relationship between the needs and demands of democracy and the resulting need and demand for an education system, and an education system of a certain type. So we're going to be looking at that for this particular video, and then after that we'll look more deeply into the concept of democratic education, which will wrap up our look at the duty of care. It's been a long investigation, a lot of videos, a lot of content, but it's really important to consider these topics when we get back, as we will in the next module, to looking at how all of this discussion of ethics plays out when we think about the decisions that we make when using artificial intelligence in education, in learning analytics, and, in society generally. Okay, so I'm going to pick up where I left off, and in fact on the same slide, on the idea of unequal relationships, partly because I wasn't completely happy with how I dealt with it last time, and partly because this really is the logical place to begin a discussion of democracy and justice and injustice and community and all of that. So, Sarah Lucia Hoagland argues that the idea of unequal relationships, which really is what's presumed in an ethics of care, are ethically problematic and consequently a poor model for an educational theory. I'm not sure that she's wrong here. She argues that on Noddings' account of ethical caring, and here this is all quoting from Wikipedia, the one caring is placed in the role of the giver and the cared for in the role of the taker. And, if we jump from this context to the wider political context, there's all kinds of rhetoric around the idea of people who are givers and people who are takers. The people who produce wealth in a society and the people who simply receive wealth from the society, etc. So the one caring in this relationship is the dominant one. To a degree, choosing what is good for the cared for, although we've talked about that, right? It's not a case where the carer simply says, this is what's good for you. But nonetheless, it's still the case that the cared for is put in the position of being a dependent, and very often in a position without any actual real power in the relationship. This comes up especially in schools where you have younger students, and there's not really much of a sense where you can say that the student has power in the student-teacher relationship. They usually have to bring in a proxy, like their parents or the school board or lawyers or something like that, right? Similarly, in healthcare, it's not the case that the patient has power with respect to the doctor, the nurse, or the hospital. And the way we know this is how poorly the concept of choice plays out in healthcare. In the US healthcare, you have to pay for your care, which means that the relationship is a transactional one, and the relationship is one where, in theory, right, the patient could choose not to pay for the treatment and then wouldn't receive the treatment. And the result of that is often death, because people can't afford to pay for the treatment. So they pay for the treatment because what else are they going to do? Or at least they say they're going to pay for the treatment and then place themselves in a lifetime of debt. Now, this is not a power relationship here, right? This is not one where the patient has equal standing with the hospital. So it's not what we might call a free market. And so creating an ethics based on this unequal relationship is problematic. Now, I was thinking about that in between doing videos. We had to buy a new fridge because the old one died. Speaking of not having power, and I had to go to the store. So I'm sitting thinking about this, and the whole concept of the ethics of care in this context is one that's told from the perspective of the person who has the power. And if you think about it, reframe it in your mind that way for a moment. The way it's depicted, right, the importance of getting the expressed need from the person being cared for, right? We're not saying, and I'm not reading so much, sentences like, if you are in a position of dependence, it is important for you to express your need. That's equally true, but we're not reading it that way, right? We're reading this as an ethic which governs the caregiver rather more than an ethic that governs the cared. And it takes me back to the old approaches to international aid, where the rich countries would decide what the poor countries needed. And yeah, they would even enter into a dialogue and a discussion and then say, well, you have to exercise restraint, you have to have, economic policies that do whatever, you have to have free market economies, you can't have social programs. And the countries basically just took it because what else are they going to do? They found themselves in this position where, through no fault of their own, they had massive social problems and deep foreign debt. And in order to be able to do commerce with the rest of the world at all, they had to accept these conditions. I thought of even less neutral ways of describing that, but I decided not to use them, but you can imagine for yourself, how all of this and the role of colonialism and the role of racism all plays into this, and we have this very unequal relationship, and then we're going to describe an ethics of that relationship, and who's it going to be addressed to? Well, the wealthy, right? The wealthy nations. So there is a sense here where the ethics of care is an ethics written by wealthy people for wealthy people. And we want to be aware of that. I want to be aware of that. Now, I'm not exactly a wealthy person, but on a global scale, well, just look at my office behind me. I'm doing pretty well compared to the rest of the world. So even me talking right now about this, I'm a wealthy person talking about ethics for other wealthy people. And part of that is I'm not going to tell a poor person what their ethics ought to be. That would be wrong. And the other part of it is, ethics is deeply and intensely personal. And so when I'm talking ethics, there's a certain sense here that I have to be talking to myself. Now, I think a lot of these considerations are taken up in the ethics of care, but not on a naive reading of the ethics of care. And maybe naive is a cruel word to use in this context. And I think that if we look at the ethics of care as also an ethics that creates what I call here a caring democracy, that we begin to at least approach some kind of understanding where the ethics that are in play aren't just an ethics of rich people. Because really that wouldn't be helpful, would it? At least I don't think so. So let's look then, we'll come back to this idea about virtues, which we talked about in the previous section, in a previous video. And we begin with the observation, and again, this is coming from a discussion of Nell Noddings from UVM, that the American tradition, and I'll say North American, I might even include the Europeans, but less to less a degree, regard virtues as personal possessions, hard won through a grueling process of character building. Now, you may recall in the previous video, I discussed whether we should think of virtue in that sense where you have less virtue if you have less virtuous characteristics. You know, if you're not as generous as you could be, it doesn't follow that you're somehow ethically less worthy. And that's what applies here. So contrast that perspective with John Dewey's perspective, where we have virtues as, quote, working adaptations of personal capacities with environing forces, right? In other words, working with what you have in the environment that you live in. And so Noddings draws from that, I think quite accurately, the observation that how good or how bad I can be depends in substantial part on how you treat me. So my ethical virtue, my virtue generally, isn't just a thing that I create. And that applies equally well for rich people and poor people. And yeah, we've had this discussion before in other contexts, right? You know, a rich person isn't rich typically because they're more virtuous than other people, no matter how they're treated in Forbes or the Wall Street Journal. A rich person is rich usually because of luck. And if it's not luck, then again, as I've said elsewhere, it's a prima facie indication of criminality. In other words, wealth very often indicates a lack of virtue. But let's go with the luck thing, mostly. So the luck aspect of wealth really boils down to how the rest of society treats you. And the way the rest of society treats somebody who lucks into wealth is it gives them money and maybe possessions. And sometimes in the olden days, people, right? Society, for whatever reason, decided to give this child who was growing up more money than it gave other children. Now, there were processes for this, like inheritance, right of primogeniture, all of that, right? You know, we can talk about the processes, but it boils down to they received more from society than other people. And remember in the previous video, I talked about, you know, how generous you can be. Bill Gates can be generous to the tune of $30 billion. I can't. Well, that depends in substantial part on how Bill Gates is treated by society as compared to me. For example, society, as it is currently constructed, grants Bill Gates the ability to form a company, the ability to retain ownership of software and only license it out, the ability to retain copyright, trademarks, patents, and therefore charge royalties for things, and so on, right? There's the whole business structure that enables the wealth of Bill Gates. So that's the observation here, right? My individual virtue, my ethical standing, or even indeed my ethical possibility, is not independent from social virtue or social ethical standing. And that's a really important realization. And that's something I think that really distinguishes an ethics of care from the other ethical theories that we've been looking at, which are mostly focused on personal individual ethics of choice as made by rational individuals, right? And the different ethical standings, or the possibility of an ethical standing for a society or a community, is relegated to something like politics or whatever. And I'll be honest here, I've said on many occasions that ethics is the domain of the personal, and I still believe that, despite what I've just said here. And politics is the mechanisms, the set of mechanisms that we need in order to have us avoid killing each other. So I don't consider politics to be part and parcel of the distribution of resources of a society. But you know, there's some fuzziness and some overlap here. So, given that, then, the duty to act as described by an ethics of care isn't like a Kantian kind of duty that is based on a deontological theory where a rational person considers what the various options are, for example, whether the principle one follows can be expressed as a universal and followed by everyone. It's more a case where there's a duty to care in the sense that it's an inclination to care. It's, you know, I've talked already about the motivation or the urgency of care as compared to this more rational thing. And this is Britannica talking. Remember, we have two male authors writing in the Britannica article. This impulse, better to call it, I think, a sentiment, is obligatory in anyone who aspires to the sense of self as a moral, caring person. Now, that's not it, right? That's a reading of the duty to care as a personal, individual obligation. But it's not something that you can pull off just by yourself. So, it's a lot like climate change, right? And there's, in a lot of cases, people are talking about, well, you know, climate change is a matter of individual responsibility, and that's why we need to choose to drive electric cars, use public transit. We, for our new refrigerator, needed to make sure that it was energy efficient and Energy Star certified and all of that. But, you know, someone like me can't do much about global warming. Just, there's a limit to what I can do. I try to keep a pretty low footprint, and for the most part I succeed, but it's society as a whole that is going to have to make this change. So, even if the climate presents itself to me as something that is urgently needed to be addressed, and therefore calls in me a duty, and I can't really be thought of as a moral caring person unless I deal with the environment, it is nonetheless a social thing. And we tend to think of social things as things that ought to be organized rationally. These rankings of duties, these universal obligations, etc. But here, what we're saying is that the inclination to care is the important thing that ought to govern our society, and not just business as usual. You see the distinction here. So, that leads us to talking about how our duties extend outward. So, quoting from Jenny McNess, who wrote a really nice summary of Nell Nodding's, universal caring is impossible. Conflict and guilt are inescapable risks of caring. We can't do all the caring for all the world at any given time. No individual can. And again, our caring is not independent of our social, economic, cultural, and other contexts, right? At the same time, here's Toronto speaking, Virginia Held's most recent account of her ethics of care treats the global as a meaningful level of care, in addition to the level of the intimate interactions of the household. For example, if NGOs can create connections of that foster care, that's nothing but good. But as long as the nation state remains the container within which care is allocated, then global unjust inequalities of care will exist. And that's because the nation state acts in its own self-interest. It's kind of like, you know, if you care only about your immediate family, that's not really an instantiation of the duty of care, because your family is embedded in this social structure, and what you do impacts people around you. You know, that's why you don't burn tires in your backyard, even if everybody in your family says it's fine, right? And countries are the same way. If we think of the country as a family, well, some countries have been burning tires in their backyard, and maybe they shouldn't have. But they didn't consider what the impact of burning tires would be on other countries, especially countries that can't even afford tires in the first place. Okay, stretching the analogy a bit too far. But you get the idea, right? So the universal is a domain of care. But we need to, and so we need to be careful not to create these artificial boundaries, separating family that we care for with everyone else, separating nations that we care for and not everyone else. At the same time, recognizing that the capacity of an individual to care for everyone is limited. It's a tough dilemma, right? I can't personally care for a starving person in Malawi. I can't, because if I did that for each starving person in Malawi, it would overwhelm me. At the same time, I can't consider the starving person in Malawi as external to or not part of what I understand to be the community about which I should be caring, right? The starving person in Malawi should generate in me some urgency to act, even if I can't care for that starving person in Malawi. It's a tough thing to express. I could throw numbers and maybe express it that way, and it's a bit of a a bad way to do it, but it'll get the idea across, and that might be. So if I fully cared for the starving person in Malawi, that might be $100, right? And I can't pay $100 to every starving person in Malawi. I just don't have that kind of money. But if I can see myself as being in a position where the starving person in Malawi matters to me, then as part of my political action and perhaps the political action of everyone involved, my community as a whole can make that $100 available. And that might mean, like, maybe 1 cent out of my pocket and 1 cent out of everyone else's pocket to make sure that that $100 is there for the starving person in Malawi. Okay, take that example as what I mean, except ignore the numerical quantitative aspects of it, because it's not going to be simply reducible to quantities. And that's kind of what I mean. And I think, I mean, the literature's all over the place on this, on what you can care for, what you can't care for, what your sphere of caring is. But I think that really is the only consistent way to talk about a duty of care. So we need to be thinking, in other words, about community. Community qua community. And again, there are different levels of community, right? There's the people on my street, the people in my town, the people in my province, the people in the world. All of those come into play. So, and what we're trying to do here is, quote unquote, build community. So this isn't about me as a rich person helping poor people. This is about me as a member of a community working toward a community such that there aren't poor people. So now we go to bell hooks. To build community requires vigilant awareness of the work we must continually do to undermine all the socialization that leads us to behave in ways that perpetuate domination. Well, that's kind of a hard thing to grasp all at once. I've put images, well, I took that quote, put it in Google, and this is what came up. Fox News and all of that, Trump, etc. So those are, I guess, the things that perpetuate domination. So what's going on here? Again, our creation of, no, wrong word, our having of moral virtues, or our capacity to behave in an ethical way, our capacity to care, is influenced by the community around us. And one of the ways the community around us influences us is to socialize us. And this is what a lot of this, critical theory and indeed critical race theory is about, right? It's about the socialization that takes place that would lead us to behave in ways that just perpetuate the domination. Simple example, maybe too simple, but we are socialized to want to drive. And especially to drive using cars that consume gasoline. So we behave in such a way that we use gasoline. But our use of gasoline requires that we support oil companies in order to receive the gasoline, otherwise we can't drive. But oil companies, in order to conduct business in the way that they do, need to do things like kill poets like Ken Saro Wiwa in Nigeria. And so our action of driving a car is behaving in a way that perpetuates the actions that the oil company took in Nigeria and that they take in other countries as well. So What Hooks is saying here is, to build community, we need to be aware of the social forces that do things like lead us to want to drive cars. Now, I mean, the criticism here, and there is one, is that that's a pretty passive way of looking at it, right? Well, I don't choose to drive a car. I just drive a car because, you know, socialization makes me want to. On the other, and it's the sort of approach that somebody who knows would talk about to someone who doesn't know, right? I know you want to drive a car, but really the reason why you want to drive a car is because you've been socialized into it. That's not right either, is it? But we are not independent of the interactions and relationships that take place in our society. So the urgency here, and you notice I'm going back to motivation and urgency, the urgency here is to be aware of these socialization factors that affect ourselves and other people to more or less a degree have their own obligation to be aware of socialization that affects them. But what does not come out of that is a sanction for us to tell them to be aware of the socialization. You see the difference here, right? It's not about me telling other people, you must be aware. It's not about me, the knowing person, the person in power and control, informing the people who have less power and control that, no, really, all your desires are just socialization. They're not real. I have the same desires too. But again, it's all just socialization. So that just doesn't fly, right? So you need to be, I'm slipping into it, right? I need to be aware of that. On the other hand, we can't just let it be the case, at least the argument is made, that anything goes. And this is the market's argument, right? So the market's argument is basically each person acting independently on their own will make decisions such that the totality of decisions will exhibit something like a wisdom of the crowds, or as Adam Smith said, the invisible hand of the marketplace. But we know that the marketplace fails. When it comes to things like inequality, poverty, the need for education, even the need for health care, to a large degree, we don't make these community responsibilities, we make these responsibilities of charity. In other words, we make them basically the basis of individual responsibility. So you have an individual responsibility to contribute to a charity that will in turn address the problem of hospitals. And so again, if we allow just all the individuals to make their own decisions in their own way, we get the desired kind of social justice that we want. Except, we don't, right? Joan Toronto, the market passes of bootstraps and charity allow self-interested behavior to allocate care responsibilities. They do so, however, only by uneven processes where those with greater resources get more care. So, if you think about it, when rich people donate to hospitals, they may donate some money to hospitals for poor people, but they're just as likely to donate to hospitals that serve, well, them. Charity begins at home, that sort of thing, right? And we see this acting in the community. Look at the foundations that support open educational resources, and look at who these foundations are supporting. These foundations are not taking all of their money and using it to develop, say, a content authoring industry in Malawi. It's just not happening. No, the charity's money, the foundation's money, goes to organizations like MIT and Stanford and Yale, Harvard, to create resources which will then be dumped on Malawi and other places. And we'll call that open educational resources, and yay, we've done charity. And that's a market failure, and it's a market failure for several reasons. For one thing, after that process, you really haven't done anything to help the people of Malawi, right? Because once they've used those resources, they're still right in the same situation that they were. And in fact, and you see this a lot with food aid, you've actually depressed the market in the recipient nation so that people who actually produce the things that they really need in that country can't compete with free. And that's an objection a lot of people have raised with respect to open educational resources as an argument for allowing, you know, commercial resale of these resources. But again, all you've done there is create, you know, an intermediary sector which takes resources, adds a price to them, and then sells them. And you still haven't developed a market capacity in that country. So market, you know, this is why Joan Tronto calls them market passes, right? These are passes, and I've mentioned this before. They're things that you can do instead of caring, right? They're a pass, like, you know, here's my pass, I don't have to care because I've provided charity. So, you know, I've done my bit. And in fact, you know, it's even worse. Because she adds, at the end of the day, given the way the market seems timeless, it becomes impossible to think structurally about past injustice in the face of market ideals. There's a reason why Malawi can't produce its own food or educate its own people. And it has nothing to do with the people of Malawi, and everything to do with the colonial history of South Central Africa, the Lakes area. But if we just say, well, we'll just let the market forces decide that, that sweeps away the full impact of that history and says, okay, well, everybody has their own voice in the marketplace, we'll just let it all play out. But the way this works is the people with more money get more votes. They support themselves, and if possible, they continue and even deepen the exploitation of those parts of the world without money to cast votes. And so that's why a market approach doesn't work. This has important consequences when we go back to talking about artificial intelligence and analytics, particularly when we think about the way these things work, because we have self-contained, independent, autonomous entities, neurons, or people, or whatever, who are interaction with the rest of the world around them, and, you know, making basically what really look like market-based decisions. And you know, we can and should ask, well, what prevents a market failure in a human neural net? And sometimes the answer is nothing. I mean, sometimes people go insane. But there are structural conditions and structural constraints in real physical neural networks and successful networks generally that don't exist in markets, which are really artificial creations of scale-free networks of distribution and resource allocation. And that's, and you read about the desire for that to continue when people talk about interfering in the marketplace, right? But in our brain, stuff interferes with what we're thinking all the time. And that is, in fact, these sentiments, these emotions, these feelings of urgency. And so I think that a care ethics would want to translate that into a social community, or as we say, a caring democracy. A democracy that's caring might have a market structure, but that market structure is going to be secondary and dependent upon the caring urgencies that are created by facts about injustice, poverty, oppression, and the rest. And the question is, what are the mechanisms for enabling that? How do you get it so that the marketplace, if you will, has a sense of care? Right now, we've actually written that out legally out of the marketplace. The major players in the marketplace literally can't care. And that's a problem. And that's why we have, that's one of the reasons why we have market failures. Different kinds of injustice arise from different causes. Here I'm drawing from Mahabali and others who are talking about open educational practices specifically, but we could talk about caring practices generally that respond to different kinds of injustice. So we have three major types listed here. I'm sure it doesn't exhaust all the ways that we can create injustice in this world. One of them is economic injustice. Simply, in economic injustice, there's a redistribution of who has access to resources and who doesn't. And the causes of that, we've talked about that already, inheritance, structural factors, all of these things that give Bill Gates $30 billion and someone in Malawi $3. That's all of those factors create economic injustice, and an ethic of care would be directed toward redressing that injustice. Similarly, with cultural injustice, this isn't so much about money and resources and access to goods and services, but recognizing and valuing people from different cultures or those cultures themselves. Here, as it says here, recognizing their culture in it, or going further to address the root causes of cultural misrecognition with acculturation. Pretty bad when I have to do phonics in a live video, isn't it? We've experienced in this country, for example, a systematic attempt through the process of residential schools to eliminate and expunge from the face of the earth the indigenous peoples' cultures, including their language, their tradition, their sources of traditional knowledge, their religion, etc. And an ethics of care would respond to that by reaffirming the value of those cultures, and going further to address not simply the fact that we attempted to eliminate the culture by reviving the culture, but going deeper and asking why we ever would have thought that was a good idea in the first place. And there are places elsewhere around the world where this sort of attack on individual cultures is still taking place. And we can think of some prominent examples, just watch the regular news. And we have to ask globally, right, why is it that we would think it's a good idea to eliminate a culture? And how can we address those factors in society that make this something that people believe? And then there are political injustices. So in the context of learning, it might, and I'm quoting, involve those normally without access in the redesign or overhaul of the learning experience, emphasizing equitable representation and parity of participation, or it might go further to address root cases of political misrepresentation through reframing and parity of rights. To me, what this gets down to is the fact that in these relationships, you have an unequal power relationship. And yeah, it's not just about power. I know that. Politics is about more than power, despite what CBC says with their show Power in Politics, right? Politics sometimes is the expression of power through nonviolent means, but sometimes it's creating mechanisms for people to work together for common goals and ends, or even, you know, interaction for the purpose of finding mutual value. There are many ways to define politics. What political injustice does is removes the capacity of a person or a group of people to participate in that process, whatever it is, whether it's power, collaboration, etc. And what an ethic of care does is, first of all, to recognize that this capacity to participate politically has been removed, first of all. Secondly, to address the consequences of that, in other words, to replace that capacity that has been removed, you know, to provide that capacity. And then third, again, to address the root causes of it. Why would we think that it makes sense, or that it's reasonable, or that it's right to deny a person or a group political process? And we're seeing that play out in the United States right now with the whole issue of voting rights. And, an ethic of care would take care to ensure that everybody has access to their right to vote, and would prioritize that over abstract rules or principles, or, as the case may be, hypothetical fears or concerns, or perhaps the simple desire of one group to dominate another. And there, again, we've talked about this. There are many causes, many ways in which someone's capacity to care may be diminished, and that's an important factor here, I think. The people who perpetuate economic injustice, cultural injustice, and political injustice, it's not simply that, you know, you can't simply say, well, these are evil people, and obviously have no virtue, and we must simply oppose them. Because, as we've stated already, they, as individuals, are not independent of their own political contexts. Somebody living and working in Western China is not living and working independently of the context in which they find themselves. Somebody living and working in Alabama, similarly, are not independent of that context. And there's a broad scope of socialization, a broad scope of social and political infrastructure, and facts and history that all play into their thoughts and feelings about injustice and whether the ethics of care should apply here and how they should apply here, etc. That's not to hold them blameless, but it's, you know, it's different from just saying, well, these people are just wrong, let's oppose them. And it means going after the structural relationships in a society that create these kind of injustices. That's why I talk a lot when I talk about networks, not about the contents of a signal from one person to another or one neuron to another. I'm kind of concerned about those, but not nearly as concerned as you might think. And I would never try to manage a network by examining the contents of those individual messages and making sure only the ones I like get through. It's just not efficient. I'm interested in the structural processes. You know, what are the mechanisms by which connections between individuals grow? What are the limits on the number of connections, the natural physical limits on the number of connections a person can have? How much influence can one entity have over another, right? How much resistance is there to the propagation of a signal? We see this come up a lot in theory of epidemiology, epidemics, pandemics like we're having now. And what they're after here is, you know, on the one hand, they're trying to get everybody to wear masks, and they're trying to get everybody vaccinated. The purpose here is not to go after each individual instance of a virus and kill it, but rather to prevent the spread by reducing the likelihood of one person passing it on to another to a low enough probability value. And that cutoff is one, right? If the probability is lower, then the virus is less likely to spread. That's why we vaccinate. That's why we use masks. It's not because they fight the vaccine directly. It's that they reduce the spread of the virus. And then, of its own accord, the virus will die out, or at least be reduced to insignificance. Same sort of thing here with injustice. Same sort of thing with open educational practices. You know, again, it's not just about here's some content, you can have it, or here's some content, I'll convert it to commercial value and then sell it. It's addressing the structural underlying factors that create the need to ensure that people have access to educational resources and an educational system that promotes their growth and their development. And then, as well, an educational system that promotes their wider growth and development more generally, you know, in a variety of ways. Social justice is the tool that we use for this. Nancy Fraser, in her account of social justice, talks about dismantling institutionalized obstacles that prevent some people from participating on a par with others as full partners in social interaction. Now, that's kind of like the political injustice here, but I think we can generalize that reasonably well to talk about the other types of injustice. So there's two ways of looking at it. In one of her earlier writings, she talks about social justice as an outcome where all relevant social actors participate as peers in social life. I'm always a bit cautious about fuzzy words like relevant, but we'll leave that aside. And then the second part, a process in which procedural standards are followed in, quote, fair and open processes of deliberation. Now, that's kind of getting back to ethics as rationality, even ethics as social contract. And social justice has a lot in common with social contract approaches, especially as it's defined like this. But I think in the context of an ethics of care, it's less about writing a context and more about making sure, as an imperative, that everybody is able to participate fully and meaningfully in the process of, well, being in a society. There was a recent special issue of Journal of Interactive Media in Education where these concepts were looked at, and in the editorial they talked about how many of the articles were based on Fraser's social justice model and flow from that. Now, of course, you see in the diagram here, again, the roots back to social contract theory. I think that's a very tenuous root link back, but it is kind of a combination of social contract theory with feminist and racial justice literature. It talks about the three kinds of injustice, the economic, cultural, and political that we talked about, and then that cashes out into, when I, just as an aside, when I say cashes out, I don't mean, you know, don't mean anything by money. It's just an expression that I use to say that becomes instantiated as. Cashes out is just an easier way to say it. As things like open textbooks, things like an open educational practices framework, professional learning for refugee advocacy, social and linguistic inclusion, critical social annotation, so that's kind of a cultural, perhaps, discussions about Nussbaum and open textbook content diversification, and you know, that seems pretty clearly to represent cultural injustice, but you know, it doesn't really matter how they line up. And you know, it even extends to things like decolonization, First Nations knowledge authority, etc., and addressing things like the digital divide, you know, recognizing that a social infrastructure and even technical infrastructure have an impact on your capacity to participate fully in society. So that leads us ultimately to what we might call caring democracies. And that takes us back to the ethics of care, back to Joan Toronto. Sorry, I misspelled it there. I always want to say Toronto in my head. I don't know why. You know, it's this little dyslexia that I have that makes it impossible for me to deal with names. It's just one of those things. Anyhow, to look at the changes that we need to make to transform into a caring democracy. Again, by caring democracy, a democracy that has an urgency to respond to expressed needs, especially from people who are vulnerable or being oppressed, right? So, first of all, that means giving people a voice in the allocation of caring responsibilities, right? You don't dump it all onto the lowest echelon of society. And we talked about that way back near the beginning of the discussion of care. And it means to recognize vulnerability rather than autonomy as a better way to understand our basic equality. Now, that's an interesting way of putting it. And I have always considered autonomy to be important, and I still think autonomy is important. And I don't think it's an either-or situation here. I don't think you make the trade-off between autonomy and vulnerability. Because what you're trying to do when you address vulnerability is to return a person to a state where they can be autonomous, you know, as much as possible within the context of the social infrastructure, and to fully participate in a society. Nonetheless, it comes down to freedom cannot simply mean the ability to choose. Agreed. Accounts of freedom that rest upon the absence of domination are preferable to those that do not. if your concept of freedom is simply, ways that individuals can autonomously express themselves, whether through speech, thought, religion, carrying guns, or whatever, it doesn't address how social structure it can change or transform into a structure that marginalizes and oppresses people, then it's not a sufficient definition of freedom. And then finally, Toronto says, adding a fifth phase to caring, that takes us all the way back to Gilligan's stages of caring, caring with, the idea that caring is something that is ongoing, that it's something that is a social thing, something that characterizes your society, your nation, ideally, the global community as a whole, understanding that a truly just and free social order would make addressing the needs of the most vulnerable its primary responsibility, rather than, say, arguing about economic systems or belief systems or competing ways of framing the world, framing value, rights, goodness, ethics, and all of the rest of that. And I think that's a point that's worth making. I think that certainly we don't have a properly and fully functioning society if we have, especially large swaths, but even individual cases where people are being oppressed, people are living in poverty. It does kind of go back to the idea, and you could probably find it in there, of every person being of worth and of value. But the reason why you treat everybody, the reason why you address vulnerability first is not based on an abstract principle that everybody is of equal value, because then people can just disagree with the principle. It becomes an imperative because of the way poverty and misery and oppression make us feel. And this ethic of care, in addition to motivating individual action, should overall motivate wider social action. And so the objective of an ethic of care, I think, is moving ourselves to a place where these imperatives can have an impact on us and influence us to action. There are different ways of doing that, different ways of approaching it, but ultimately, I think that's probably what it boils down to. So that's Caring Democracies. I still want to talk about a democratic education or pedagogy of care, and that'll be the next video. So, and might wrap up the series. I'm not sure if that'll be the last one or not. It might be. It probably will be. And then we'll do the wrap up and summary. So, thanks for listening. I know this went on for a while, but I think it addresses a really important aspect of the ethics of care, and I think makes, the considerations in this video, are considerations that make the ethics of care stronger, more defensible. And that's a big part of what I'm trying to do in this discussion. I talked about all the caveats off the top of these presentations. I probably should have said more about what I'm trying to do here is represent the position of ethics of care in as strong and not defensible, that's the wrong word, but as in as strong and robust a way as possible, so that people, including myself, can see why it is intuitively appealing and why it has become more so popular recently. So that's it for this video. I'm Stephen Downs. Thanks for coming along with me for the ride, and I'll be talking to you in the next one. See you then.